Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
On DAB, online, on the app, and on your smart speaker. This is My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
This is My Sporting Life, and I'm Paul Coit, and with us today, one of this country's best known and most enigmatic rugby players. Was the youngest Wasp ever to make his debut in the Premiership. He won a Heineken Cup final and a Premiership final before then playing in France and Japan, New Zealand, and then back to England with Wasps and finishing his career with Northampton Saints. Represented England 77 times, playing in two World Cups, British and Irish line on the 2017 drawn series to New Zealand. And after he'd retired, an MMA fighter, a DJ, TV personality, podcaster, successful author, and no stranger to controversy with his sporting life, James Haskell.
Well, you've got such a good, powerful radio voice. I love it.
It's my job. It's I could say the good. Same thing about no. you when you're playing rugby.
I'm about to say, if you think I've got a good radio voice, you and I would both be lying, because I listen to myself back sometimes and I'm like, oh, goodness.
Oh, come on.
But you've got great. It's very powerful.
Oh,
I quite like it.
Oh, come on.
If you were listening to that voice, you imagine you were like sort of 8 foot tall, white tuxedo.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, you've got the height right. It's
yeah.
It's just the clothing slightly
thing is,
different.
That's the beauty of medium of radio, is that you could be anything.
Well, you were born on the 2nd of April 1985. James, can you give us a little idea of what it was like growing up and a little bit about your family as well?
Yeah, well, firstly, I was actually due to be born on April the 1st, but my mum was like, absolutely not.
Is that right?
Yeah. She crossed her legs and said, no. April Fool's baby with my personality would not have been great. I mean, I was very lucky. My parents are still together. I had a very good childhood. I sort of wanted for nothing, really, and kind of almost describe it as a privileged kind of background. And actually, it was interesting enough because my first sort of sojourn into kind of proper rugby when I went all the way, well, did all the trials for England under 16s, went through the horrific county and school system that takes about 6 months to achieve is enough to put you off for life. And actually got all the way to the end and I didn't get in. And that disappointment was my first sort of real disappointment. You know, like my parents sort of worked above and beyond to pay for anything that we wanted and stuff to their detriment and their financial sort of well-being. But, you know, I was okay. I didn't really know about hardship in any way. And obviously everything I say is relative to me. You know, people listen and go, you don't know anything. But you can only talk about the context that you know. And that moment was really sort of seminal in everything I did, because I got there, I didn't get in, I was told I didn't get in, and then I was left with that reality of like, well, why didn't I get in? I was like, well, you didn't put all the extra work in, you didn't do what you were supposed to do, you didn't dedicate yourself. And my dad said to me at the time, look, you can either see it as a disappointment and you can just play rugby for fun and we can leave it, or you can go away, work harder than you ever worked, go back, trial for the England under 18s and see what you can do. And that journey, with me training with someone three times a week and the dedication and focus that it took, set me up on a journey to where I am now. And all the things you've listed, you know, there's a great saying, is a jack of all trades is a master of none, but oftentimes better than a master of one.
There we are.
And kind of that mindset of, you know, dedication and focus. If you put the hard work in, if you ask for help, if you, reach out to other people, if you are constantly on a journey of self-development, if you don't think you've made it, you will achieve what you want to do and you'll have a rich life. And honestly, if I was to die this afternoon, I'd pretty much say that I've had a go at everything. You couldn't, for all my faults, the fact I'm a hugely acquired taste, I've had a good go at it, and I've got no regrets. And that for me was born out of that moment, because it showed me that if you applied the lessons of things I've talked about, dedication, focus, hard work, having a plan, wanting to get better, you can pretty much go into most things. And, you know, like DJing, MMA, book writing, podcasting, I've got a production company, all these kind of different things.
Yeah.
And I've done it all with a smile on my face while upsetting everybody who's like, you can't, you shouldn't like that. You can't have that much fun. How have you done this? This is awful. And I've got a wonderful tattoo on my arm that says the best revenge is living well. And I think that's a great lesson for life, especially in the world of social media and finger pointing and everyone looking over everyone else's business and go, you can't do that, you shouldn't do that, this is how we're going to do it. It's like, listen, don't worry about what anyone else, just do you, and that is offensive enough to them.
Well, look, let's go back a bit, because
I went ahead,
I mean, you pretty much finished the show and we're only 5 minutes in.
So we needed, there's a couple of life lessons, just cherry pick those and we'll just
thank
carry
you so
on.
Much for that. But when you were a kid, was there, there's obviously a talent there. When did you, when you were at school, when was there a decision to make whether you think, I'm going to do this or I'm going to become a professional rugby player? Because, you know, you were very young when you started playing for Wasps, weren't you?
Yeah, I think because I had very supportive parents who always put me first. And it was very much the Haskells against the world, rightly and wrongly. Subsequently and later in life, I've realised that the Haskell way is not always the right way. Yeah. But when you're younger, my parents were very much like that. But they always provided the opportunity, but they weren't like, you know, pageant mothers from America, like trying to relive their youth through their child or forcing me to do it. They just provide the opportunity. If I moaned or whined or said, I don't like it, don't want to do it, they'd be like, listen, just give it a try.
Yeah.
You know, it's like with food. I don't like it. Have you ever eaten it? No.
Sure.
Well, give it a try. See how you get on. Same thing with sport. Look, I've seen this, but give it another go. And they were supportive like that. Never forced me to do anything. And then it was me basically getting into that mindset of I would, and it was as simple as, I started lifting weights and I saw change. And it's amazing. Once you see change, you find something's worthwhile, you get onto it. And it's a lot for a lot of people in a lot of areas. It's they give up before they see the benefit. But if you can stick with something and get over that hump, more often than not, you feel the benefit. And it doesn't matter whether it's learning a language, whether it's training, whether it's a relationship. If you can stick with it and get over it, it makes a huge difference. And for me, that was very much the case with this. And I you know, I started to lift weights, and I could, when I first started training, I couldn't even lift the bar up, you know, 20 kg bar bench press. I was tall and skinny. I started to develop a six pack. I started to be able to lift heavier weights. People started to notice, compliment. I mean, it didn't work with girls. I mean, I was, unfortunately, at my time at Wellington, it coincided. I mean, I've always had a bit of like a body like Baywatch, face like Crime Watch, but they in that period of time, it was sort of, they had the anti-establishment thing, anti-training, anti-diet. It was cooler to be smoking in the bushes.
Of course it was.
You know, be sort of listening to, you know, Nirvana and being sort of quite edgy, whereas being fit and healthy. I mean, I remember one time I took a shot off and a girl went, oh, it looks like you're made of plastic. And I was like, is that not a good thing? And she was like, no. So I've always been slouch.
How I miss those days.
Yeah, exactly. Extensive six-pack and huge bicep. So that was kind of quite... it was weird for me. So those kind of things made a difference, but it was more me personally.
So what was your goal? Did you have a goal?
No,
you're getting yourself into this amazing shape, and was it thinking this is going to make me the best rugby player that I can be, or what?
It was the pursuit of, you know, I had an objective and the next thing was to trial for this and to get better.
Right.
And it was because I'd never done it. And then once you... It's a perpetuation of something. So once you actually start getting results, obviously, I would always recommend to someone have a game plan. So, for example, if someone's overweight, right, it's not just about losing weight and what the scales show. It's like, what is your perception of the end goal? Like, where would you be comfortable? Because if you're never comfortable, how is anyone ever supposed to get you there?
Sure.
But I think because I was sort of just making headway and I was being more physical in games and school games, I was playing, and then because I got into England under-18s a year and a half later, end up being captain of the side. It showed me that, oh my goodness, if you put this work in, it makes a difference. Then when you're on that radar, Wasps start picking you up, and Wasps, you know, start inviting you to academy days, and other clubs start talking to you. And I was going through my A levels at the top, my AS levels. I think they've got rid of them now, and A levels. And then I basically did a pre-season with Wasps.
Is this exciting? Is this incredibly
exciting?
It was.
Well, at the time, it was amazing because I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I never wanted to be a doctor, never wanted to be a lawyer, had no idea. So I basically applied to, did my UCAS form, and I applied to different universities, Durham. They sort of laughed at me. And then I applied to read history at Exeter. They accepted me.
Yeah.
And then I had a pre-season with Wasps with, you know, my heroes. Because I'll be honest with you, when I was younger, you look at younger generations now, they're so full of knowledge for their sport. They absolutely live what they're doing. So they love their, you know, they all wear the kits. They all get into it. They've got access to social media. I was oblivious to sports teams until about 13, 14, when my dad started to support Wasps. I then started to go to every home game and every away game. So I would come out of school on the weekends and start watching it. Then I started getting idols and heroes like Lawrence Dalio, Joe Worsley, Simon Shaw. And then because of the beauty of rugby being very different than football, that the sports stars are still quite accessible, you got to meet these heroes. So then I had some people to look up to, and I was like, this is amazing.
How are you with them, by the way?
So I have a great expression for super fans called nauseas, because ultimately they're quite nauseating. They'll come up to you and they'll tell you, you know, well, listen, I'd be playing for England if it wasn't for a knee injury.
All those stuff, right? Yeah.
And I remember saying to Joe Worsley after my first year at WAS, and some kids would drive me mad for an autograph, and something happened. I said, oh, God, these kids are so boring. And he went, well, I tell you what, Hass, just remember this. When I was coming up, there used to be this horrible big-nosed kid that used to come out of nowhere, always be asking us what we're eating, could we have kit and sign autographs? I was like, oh, God, he sounds awful. Is he around here now? And he went, it was you, mate. So just appreciate what you've got. And that kind of, I suddenly realised, you know what, I was very privileged to have that. So it was a good wake-up call, a slight moment of arrogance on my part, to the point that I was very lucky that people were interested. And because of that, I was a super fan. You know, Lawrence's mum, God rest her soul, was brilliant. I used to meet her after games, give me bits of Lawrence's old England kit. I was walking around in BT Cellnet jackets. Lawrence was, like, obviously very kindly humouring me. And then I got a pre-season with them. Then I played a game. Then I went back to school, which kind of ruined my last year of school because I'd had this taste of professional sport. I'd been hanging around with the creme de la creme of rugby. Mm. And then I went back to schoolboy rugby. I finished that, did my A-levels, and then I joined Wasps in the summer, and just to give it a try for 1 year to see how I get on. 19 and a half seasons later, I was still doing it. And that is essentially how it happened. There was never one moment or epiphany where I want to do it. It was, while I'm in it, I'll do the best I can. So while I'm trying to do something, I will dedicate myself to it. And that's always been the mindset. It's never been a long-term goal. But once I got to about 21 and there was a bit of a sense of I could maybe play for England, I wanted that. Mm. And then I didn't just want one cap, I wanted 50 caps. I didn't want 50 caps, I wanted 100. And then you want the Lions, and then you want to play in different clubs. Then you want the Barbarians. And that is how my mind works. But there was never some grand plan. There was never a projection. I don't know what I would be doing if I hadn't done that now, because I just had no other interest, because nothing sparked my flame like that did.
Well, it worked. Coming up next, we get onto James being picked for England, which, knowing him, he's never going to go exactly to plan, and the first of 77 England caps in front of a packed Millennium Stadium in the Six Nations against Wales. All coming up next on My Sporting Life with James Haskell.
My Sporting Life with James Haskell on Talk Sport.
It's 2003. And James, you're incredibly fit, incredibly dedicated, and although you're still only at school, you make your professional debut for Wasps, which was in France, wasn't it?
Yes, I was actually playing against Clermont-Ferrand, it was called, and I was 17 at the time. I got they read the lineup up, and I was in a back row with Lawrence Dalio. And I never forget before the game, Lawrence Dalio, kind of, you know, he's a jutting jaw, big bravado, big sniff that he says, you know, talks like that. It's got a bit of it's weird because he went to Ampleforth, but he's sort of a Mockney geezer. You'd think he was a feature in EastEnders if you weren't careful. You know, he's like a star out of Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels. And he went, listen, Hask, if it kicks off today, mate, I need you right next to me.
Right.
If anyone, if there's a fight, I need you there. So I was like, yes, Lawrence.
Right. Did you think, yes, Lawrence?
Yeah, I was like, I did think yes, Lawrence. Okay. But I was also like, I'm not sure I've got skill set quite if it kicks off. Bear in mind that public school boys, they like to think they're hard, but not really from the mean streets of anywhere. Do you know what I mean? The mean streets of Harrow's not really of Windsor, where I was born. It doesn't quite have the same, you know, sort of kudos as South London.
Yeah, it's not Peckham, is it?
It's not Peckham.
No.
So I said this to him, and I was like, you know, yeah, no problem. And if it does kick off, I was like, I'm not sure what to do. So anyway, Phil Greening tackles Auriel Rougerie into touch, right? And Auriel Rougerie actually sued Phil Greening because of this, because he said that he forearmed Auriel Rougerie in the throat and damaged his throat. This is kicked off in the sideline. Lawrence has punched some bloke. So I've stood there and gone, Well, he's punched someone, so I've turned around and punched this French guy right in the face. I haven't done anything. And this French guy hasn't moved. He's turned around and just punched me straight back. And I used to have a brace on the inside of my teeth after my parents spent a fortune on orthodontic. And this brace just went ping straight out my mouth. I sort of wheeled away dazed. The whole thing kicked off into the stands. The physios got involved. My mum, I saw this French guy hit me. She's trying to get over the stand to nut him. It's all kicked off. But that was kind of my first taste of it. And I was punching people. I'm not sure why, all because Lawrence told me that I had to do it.
So that is a proper baptism of fire.
Oh, yeah.
That was the baptism of fire.
It was. And then...
Did you enjoy it?
I did, but it was a massive wake-up call because I played that game. Then I went back to Wellington to play in the last year of school.
Yeah.
And I realised what a golf that was. You know, bear in mind, that was a pre-season game and I was off the pace, out of breath, got filled in, didn't have the skill set, didn't know all the moves. And, you know, I then was like, wow, I've got a long, long way to go.
So Warren Gatland is the coach at this time.
Yes,
is that right?
Is, yeah,
so I know that there's certain coaches that are huge influences on you and they all seem, you know, very similar, if you don't mind. Yeah. I mean, if I think of Warren Gatland, so... Did he take you under his wing and think, you know, this kid is going to go somewhere? And how long was it after that game in France that then you made your way into the first team and you were playing regular first team rugby?
I'd say around 19 was when everything started to kick on. And Gats was a huge influence. I'd say Sean Edwards even more so.
Yeah.
For two reasons. You know, Sean was very cutting, you know, be like, mate, listen, Hass, mate, there's too many mistakes around you, kid. If you can't pass, just run. And I was like, yeah, but Sean, I think rugby players need to be able to pass. But he was great because he was such an emotional energy giver. He was a coach that constantly wanted to work on himself. And he taught me to be super aggressive, super physical, and really helped me achieve what I was going to do in perfect unison. If it wasn't for them as well, they loved my character. You know, if I'd gone to Leicester Tigers early on in my career, I mean, Martin Johnson would have killed me, Lewis Mead would have killed me, and I would have never played again.
Yeah.
Wasps allowed me to have a personality and to work hard. And I think it was the perfect storm, because if I'd been to any other club, I wouldn't have made it either.
So 2007, I mean, it was a huge year for you, wasn't it? Because England, I know that you mentioned that as well. You played under-17s, under-18s, under-19s. Didn't you play at Wales as well, didn't you?
I did Wales under-18s at the same
time. Keeping your options open at all times?
Well, I did, because I basically... You had two age groups under-18s,
right.
and I'm actually Welsh qualified, Irish qualified, and Scottish qualified. But everyone always takes great delight.
We all are somewhere.
Yeah,
right,
sorry, but always takes great delight in telling me that I wouldn't have got into any of these teams if I was. But I remember that I did Wales trials and England trials, and I got a phone call like, "Right, James, it's Trevor here. Right, it's unbelievable. You know, you've been selected. We can't wait for you to you know to come down to training. See you, in a couple of weeks." And I was like, oh, "Thanks very much, Trevor. It's amazing." And I got a phone call from England. You know, "James, you know, great honour, lovely. You know, welcome to." You know, England under-18s. And I told my dad, and my dad was like, "We're going to have to make a decision. You've got 2 years at England under-18s as opposed to one at Wales. You're more English. You know, what's the story?" So I remember calling up. I was like, "Hi, Trevor, it's James Hasker. Look, I just need you to know I'm in the England squad." "I don't understand, James. What do you mean?" I was like, "Well, I'm in England squad." "Well, but you're Welsh, James. The whole time we've seen you, you're Welsh. You've been training the whole time." I was like, "Look, I'm going to go with England." Yeah. "Right, well, make sure you never, ever, ever come back to Wales, will you?" So that was it. And I upset them.
Well, the irony is that your debut was at the Millennium Stadium, wasn't it, for England? Now, was it everything that I would imagine it to be? You make your England debut, you're there in the Welsh screaming, singing fans around you. What was it like?
I'll tell you the first thing. So everyone has this expectation when you get called up for the national side that perhaps a silver salver arrives with a footman with an invitation on it, and you open it and you're like, you know, "James, you know, delighted to pleasure of you in the English squad."
Yeah.
This is how I found out I was in the English squad. I was driving out of the car park of Wasps, and a player called Tom Palmer used to live on the training ground.
Yeah.
And he shouted out the window an expletive I won't mention, but he said, "Oi, something, you're in the England squad, check your email." And I can, because on radio I can't say, but my email at the time was not particularly savoury. It was one of those ones, like a Hotmail account that you used to have. It's in one of my books, where you thought it'd be funny. Not even my mum would send me emails on this address, because she couldn't bring herself to do it.
Right.
And it was all spam. I logged in there, and lo and behold, there was an email that said, "To whoever it may concern, you know, you've been selected for training down in Bath for the game versus France."
Yeah.
In the Six Nations 2007. And I looked at it and I thought it was a wind up, but it was like martincorrie@gmail.com, Johnny Wilkinson at Hotmail. These aren't the real emails before you nutter start emailing
I'm
them.
I'm sitting there.
I know.
I thought I'm going to get Johnny Wilkinson
people,
on this show.
People on the radio are like, really? It's like, no, you keenos, absolutely not. So anyway, I read it and lo and behold, at the bottom of this thing was Hotmail.com. So and it said drive down. And so I took my nan, well, it was my car, but it used to be my nan's Vauxhall Astra. And I set off several days to get down to Bath because it didn't really have the power. And I got down there and Brian Ashton met me in the car park. And I was like, oh, fair play, Brian Ashton's come out. And he's come up to me, he's like, James, really excited to have you down here. Couldn't be more excited for you to make the England squad. Big week for you. Mm. Let me explain how it works. Right, so you come in on a Sunday evening. So I've got a meeting tonight. Right, Monday, huge training day. Mm-hmm. Right, meeting Monday evening and then the biggest training day of your life, Tuesday morning. And at lunchtime, we decide on the team and then we start training on the Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right, all to play for.
Sure.
Look after yourself. So I was like pumped.
Brilliant.
I was like, yes, I'm in the England squad. So I got my kit, my new wheelie bag, and I walked into reception like, bam. I was like, this is amazing, I'm on fire. Walked up to the receptionist and I went, she went, name? I was like, you obviously know it. She was like, I don't. I was like, okay. They do now though, but back in the day they didn't. So I'm only joking. And she said, Mr. Haskell. She went, all right, James Haskell, typed it in. And she went, just stay in the two nights, is it? And I went, what? She went, it says you're checking out on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait. Run it again, love.
Yeah.
Because you could say love back in the day. Run it again, love. Typed it in. She went, nah, it says you're checking out Tuesday. And that's how I discovered that I was in the England team from a bloke who lived in a training ground. And then how I discovered that I wasn't in the selection by the hotel receptionist. And people at the pinnacle go, that's what professional sport is. It must be all professional. That's genuinely how I found out. So then I went back the following week.
Yeah.
And she went, oh, when I checked in, she went, oh, checking out Friday, is it? And I was like, well, I'm obviously in the team. Then made my debut. And Millennium Stadium, I had no expectation. I just ran out for the warm-up, all the flame cannons. Then the Welsh come out, the whole place erupts. It gives me goosebumps now talking about it. And you turn to face your crowd and you see all these people in front of you. And you can see your family where you're giving them tickets and stuff. And you look there and the national anthem goes. And you either think, am I going to... defecate myself, or am I gonna deal with it? I could not stop smiling. So I sort of sat there and I couldn't stop smiling. I was like, wow, this is why you sacrifice every day off, every holiday, why you dedicate your life, why you don't eat that meal, why you don't drink that drink, why you want to give up your time. This is what it's about. This moment here, 80,000 people.
England, well, the side that did so well, turned the tables on France. The core remains. Joe Worsley moves over to number 8 in the first cap. For James Haskell at 6.
And then we played the game and we were behind, and I'll never forget, we were 5 points behind with 15 minutes to go and we were 5 metres from their try-line. Magnus Lund was playing back row, made a half break, almost fell on the line. The crowd was so loud, it was like an oppressive force, and everybody always talks about the 16th man. I'll be honest with you, fans, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, it's often rhetoric. Mm. It's like, yeah, the fans were great today. Yeah, if you're at Twickenham, they're very corporate. Yeah. So if things are going well, they're great. They're a bit, they're like sort of a fair weather. If things are going badly, sure. You can't hear them. They're all like muttering into their pints of Guinness.
Yeah.
In Wales, because these other sort of countries are allowed to be nationalistic and because if you have a St George's flag in the UK, you're immediate leader of the BNP. Whereas all these guys can dress as tulips, as paddies, as St Patrick's Day is wear kilts. We dress up like St George. Everyone's like, oh, racist.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have this kind of thing, and they are cheering so loudly that it was so oppressive that I couldn't think.
Right.
I couldn't even focus on what I was doing. And it was so, you were like, wow, it's discombobulating. And then we sadly lost the game, but that for me was a bug. It was like,
you played well though. Didn't you?
I did all right. I did all right. I mean, listen, it was the first time that an all club, a same club back row had started. Myself, Joe Worsley, Tom Rees, all it was. And that was it. And the rest was history. And then I didn't get into the 2007 World Cup off the back of that. I thought it was. They chose some other people. And I then didn't play again until 2008. I played 2007 warm-up game against France at Twickenham, where Sebastian Chabal ran over Nick Abendanon, ended Nick Abendanon's tournament and started the journey of Chabal being the icon of that particular World Cup. And in 2008, I was back in the mix, and from 2008 to 2019, I was there the whole time, really in and out a couple of times where they experimented with a few other players. We found the next Richie McCaw. Turns out they hadn't found the next Richie McCaw, and they were like, "Oh, do we still got James Hassell's number? All right, we'll wheel him out again." And round and round we went.
Still to come, James leaves Wasps to play in France and Japan, and his two disastrous World Cups with England. All coming up next on My Sporting Life with James Haskell.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with James Haskell on Talk Sport.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with James Haskell on Talk Sport.
So, James, you've been Wasps' youngest ever player, and after missing out on the 2007 World Cup, you are now regularly playing for England, but there's a sting in the tail to come at Wasps, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But firstly, is there a huge difference that you've got to get used to from playing domestic rugby to playing for England?
There is. I think that's what Eddie Jones has found as England coach. One of the hardest things is that you develop these professional standards with your international team, and then you all go back to your clubs, and all clubs have different standards of what they think is acceptable, what's hard work, what's high performance, what's not. And that, I think that's one of the biggest fundamental issues without getting on my soapbox, with English rugby, is the clubs and everybody is all pulling their own directions. They're all self-serving. They don't care about the national team. Whereas in New Zealand, having played there, everything about that league is about making the All Blacks better. The off-field stuff's in sync. The players' values are in sync. And so you always have that drop-off in standards. I was very lucky because a lot of the Wasp players were with me in the England squad.
Yeah.
And apart from the Leicester clique that kind of were dominant at that period of time, we were the second most dominant team. And so it was a very different approach. But actually, I was lucky because Wasps at that time were the most professional Premiership club, you know, without bar none. And they developed the whole periodised training. They were into supplementation. They were into high performance, into rest periods, into training for only 45 minutes, where a lot of these other teams were doing 2-hour training sessions. We would, and that's how we'd win the Premiership. We'd come fourth and then just batter everyone in the final leagues and then win it. And everyone's like, "That's not fair." You're like, "Listen, guys, we're just playing to the rules." And that's what we did.
So 2009, you left, though.
I did.
So why did you go?
I left because I was hugely underpaid at Wasps for a long period of time. And I know it's vulgar to talk about money. But
that's fine. But compared to the other players?
Yes.
Or?
Oh, no. Compared to everybody. So I was playing for England on, you know, I would have been the lowest paid player for England for about 5 years in a row. Wasps used to trade off the fact that if you stayed with them, you'd win things. That's how you did it, right? Yeah. And they had Lawrence Denalio, you know, Simon Shaw, Alex King, Fraser Waters, Josh Lucy, Stuart Abbott, all these kind of, you know, heroes of the game. And we'd win everything. But when they started that, those guys used to retire. They didn't recruit anybody. They were badly managed financially off the field. They almost went bankrupt about 18 times. And so it took me 2 years to negotiate my contract. Then a guy called Steve Hayes came in, and he's like a mate of mine, but he came in. You got eight of us in a room, got Rafael Ibanez to tell us how bad other clubs were and how good Wasp was. It handed us individual sealed envelopes, said he's refusing to pay agents' fees. And we've got 24 hours to decide on his offers. And this offer was half of what it had taken me 2 years and a boatload of trouble to get to.
Wow.
So I got all the team together, like, and my dad had given me this analogy that the Friends cast used to individually negotiate their contracts,
yeah,
and some would be paid more.
Mm-hmm.
When they got together as a collective, they said, listen, you renegotiate as one body, you can't lose us all. Hmm. So I got all the troops, a bit like a union leader, in a room. I got Tom Rees, got everyone in the room.
You were Joey Tribbiani.
I was Joey Tribbiani. Well, yeah. I'm obsessed with food and women, but at a time, but I had slightly more intelligence than his character. But I was sort of the rabble rouser, and yeah. Got everyone together. Tom Rees folded in 0.3 seconds because they'd offered him the captaincy. So
fine.
He didn't want to rock
fine.
The boat. So fine. I was like, don't hold it against him. Fine. Another player wanted to leave. And there was eight of us left. And I said to him, listen, they're going to put pressure on us. They're going to try to divide us. They're going to bully us. But if we stay together, they can't afford to lose us all. And eventually, after wearing a few guys away, Tom Palmer left to go to San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
I held out. And once I was allowed to start talking to other clubs, I went to Ospreys in Wales, and I was really keen on that because Alwyn Jones was playing there. I played against him at lots of age group. He was a high performance guy, loved his extras, had the same mentality as me. I thought brilliant. Jerry Collins, RIP, was playing there. The whole Welsh team was that Ospreys team at the time. Incredible, great setup.
Mm-hmm.
I then got to talk to Stade Français and Max Cuisini, the owner, one of the greatest owners in rugby history, asked me to come and meet him. And I looked at the team sheet: Sergio Parisso, Juan Hernandez, Dimitri Sarzeski, Julien Dupuy, Pierre Rabadan, to name a few, Pascal Pape. I was like, well, in Paris, they play in pink shirts, they do naked calendars, they live they're known as the Playboys of France. Surely there is not a better synergy between me and them. So I went and met them. They offered me more money than I could have ever dreamed of in comparison to what I was on. And I looked at it and I went, if I'm going to test myself and I've got aspirations to be a great rugby player, why not go to France? Because at Wasp, we lived for those Heineken Cup weekends. We lived for those things. I got to play that every single week.
Mm-hmm.
At Wasp, when you played Toulouse or Toulon or Castres, that was big. That was me every single week, travelling around Paris, playing with these utter superstars. My journey into work was, I lived two streets down from the Arc de Triomphe in this incredible house. I used to drive past the Champs-Élysées, past the Eiffel Tower, on the Périphérique, into the Bois de Boulogne. We would sit and have big lunches. We would travel around Paris. And it was amazing.
Vamos! Ça peut être bon, ça, ouais! Magnifique essai de James Haskell.
And I left and I had no regrets. And then I got a phone call halfway through my second year. Sean Edwards was like, mate, we want you back. And I said, look, my journey's not finished yet. I'd love to come back, but I want to do more. I wanted to stay at Stade. Unfortunately, that didn't work out because, unfortunately, the owner sort of got caught up in one of those scams and ended up selling it to these business people with absolutely no money.
Yep.
He got stitched up, which is very unfortunate. Sold to a SIM card giant who wasn't prepared to pay. I then was like, look, I want to do Super 15. If you do Super 15, you've got to do Japan because the seasons don't line up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And then after those times, I signed a deal with Wasps. And my first experience at Wasps was I came back to a club that was utterly broken.
Why did you go back there?
Because I'd already signed the deal with them. The point was, if they'd paid me what I'd wanted in the first place and never would have left, they ended up paying, double what I wanted for me to get me back. And I was like, I was comfortable. I was like, vindicated. I was like, this is fine. The thing about leaving Wasps was they always said, if you leave Wasps, you never make it. And at that time, it was true.
Mm.
People had left. I'll never forget, Warren Gatland came in one day and said, right, this player X, he's not welcome at the training ground anymore. He doesn't want to play for us next year. He's not signed, so he can get away. And he created this culture of, if you're on the outside, you're never welcome. And basically, no one had ever left and made it. And that was the greatest incentive to me. And I went to Stade. I played every single game for England, never missed it, missed it, went round the world and came back. And they paid double what I wanted to. And I came back and I was like, boom, that's me. That's proven.
Well, look, I'm going to get to some World Cups in just a second. But the story, though, with Wasps, see, it didn't end well either, did it?
No, it didn't. It didn't end well. And it's sad. But I'm very big boy about this stuff. It was sad because it didn't need to end that well, and they were vindictive in the end, and they didn't need to me. But the point was, the worst thing you can do to talk to players, especially young men, is to talk to them like they're idiots. And we were talked like we were idiots. And I had to take them on strike because we weren't getting paid. lads were getting injured. The training ground. So we moved up there to Coventry, this all singing, all dancing stadium, with the chance that we were going to have this facility.
Yeah, Rico Arena.
Rico Arena we bought. 4 years later, we're still training out of Travel Lodges at a Tuesday, Thursday night rugby club. And they would forget to pay the generator bill for the oil. Mm. So what would happen is you'd come in, you'd be training at 7 o'clock in the morning in the dark in the gym. The ice machines would all melt, so everything would be flooded. The training pitches, they'd had put drainage in, but they'd done it on the cheap, so they flooded. So we had a full-time grounds, but we couldn't train, so we were AstroTurfs at school. None of the bills were paid. I didn't get paid my image rights for a year. And just went on and on and on to the point where I had to take them all on strike. And then instead of listening to us, they just spent all their time trying to find out who the ringleader was.
Ugh.
And then it just went round and round and round. And, you know, the point is, the reason why no one... I wrote this book, and the reason why no one ever came out and challenged it, because it's all true.
Mm.
But the final pièce de résistance to that was that at the end of season thing, I'd done 12 years at WAS. They put me on a table out by the bins for my leaving thing, and they sat me with people. And to do my leaving thing, they got me up on stage with Mark Durden-Smith, with another player called Guy Thompson, who I absolutely love. He's a mate of mine.
Yeah.
Gave me 30 seconds on stage to say goodbye to me after 12 years. Asked him one question, asked me one question, gave me a framed photos of me over the years, and sat me on my way. And I was like, that's what you get for 12 years. I know, and lots of fans go, well, when I leave my business, no one still contacts me. I was like, no, you haven't given your body, your soul to your job. Like, I know people work hard, but I've literally sweated and bled for this team, and the owner knew exactly what he was doing and did it. And that was my final thing, with Mark Durden-Smith making some rubbish joke. I love Durden, he's amazing, but some cheap joke with Guy Thompson on stage, and he knew exactly what they were doing. And I was like, fair play, if that's what you want to do. I've never been back, never been invited back, never spoken to them. And the last time I went there, the bloke came out of his box and was giving me evils. And I was like, what? The mistake he makes is that when in real world, a lot of times when you work for business, you have a teacher-pupil relationship. Like, you don't rock the boat. I don't work there anymore. Like, I don't care. Give me evils all I want. There's nothing you're going to do about it. So it's a bit sad. But then I got to Northampton, and actually, they made up for it. They welcomed me like I'd been there the whole time. Not necessarily all the fans, because some of them were like...
And you got the respect, I guess.
I did. And from the players, and I had a great time, and I got to hang around, and they looked after my family. And I was like, wow, amazing training facilities, wonderful club. And once the fans realised they hadn't paid me any money to come there, because they thought I was like some washed up player that they'd spent a fortune on, I was on nothing. But I only went there just because I wanted to play and get in for England. Unfortunately, that didn't work out. But it works out in the end. And do you know what? I'll always have a fondness in my heart for WAS, but I'm very good at kind of compartmentalising. And while I've told the story today, that's the first I've thought about it in a period of time. Like a rolling
stone. If there was a 15 of the most capped England players of all time, James Haskell would be in there. More on representing his country, the England coaches he worked with, and two disastrous World Cups. I'm Paul Coit, all coming up next on My Sporting Life with James Haskell.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with James Haskell on Talk Sport.
So, James, 77 caps, and if there was a 15 of the most capped England players of all time, you'd be in the starting lineup.
That is incredible.
That's not bad going, is it?
It is not bad going.
You must be proud of that.
I am proud of that. Considering someone once said, I can sum up the problem with English rugby in two words, James Haskell.
Oh,
and that was the bottom of a Guardian article as well. But people, I don't know the political spheres that each paper writes into, so you never know what. I can't remember what. You know, there's a great thing out of Yes, Prime Minister, where he says, you know, the Times are read by the people who run the country, the Telegraph's read by the people who think they ought to run the country, the Guardian thinks it's read by people who think other people are running the country. I don't know what it means, but essentially people think I was rubbish.
Well, that's nonsense. 2011, let's go to the World Cup then in New Zealand. Martin Johnson was the manager, World Cup winning captain, of course. Should have all worked going down, and it was, well, what was it?
An utter debacle from start to finish. Basically, it started badly and ended badly with the point of a hotel maid making up a load of allegations against myself and Dylan Hartley, which proved to be utter nonsense. We got fined about 20 times for having too many Nike ticks on our bags, wearing Opro gum shields. Manu decided it was a great idea to jump off a ferry. I mean, it just got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. We lost. Nick Easter was supposed to be playing and then hurt his back, bungee jump. It was awful. And then when we had one day, we had a team day out, and I remember they went, listen, we want you to take Sky and Getty with you, the photographers, on your day off. And I said, John, I don't think it's a good idea. He's like, you'll do as you're told. And I said, listen, I don't think you should do it. He goes, listen, I'm not arguing with you. It took us on a day, we did the Big Four, helicopter ride, canyon swing, whitewater rafting, I think, and something else. And they just took all the photographs, filmed it. As soon as that happened, and Mike Tindall's thing happened, yeah. Where he got, you know, where he got wrongly accused, it just turned into Tindall's stag do, and it just went round and round. They used all the images. It was awful. We were persona non grata, and we turned back, came home into a private terminal at the airport, and we were labelled the worst English touring side of all time. Beyond anything that ever happened.
Was any of this fair?
I think it was all fun and games until there's a great movie called The In-Betweeners movie, and there's a guy called Simon on it, and he sees this girl on the beach, and he's on this ferry, and he gets drunk, and he's like, I'm going to swim. And he goes, you can do it. And he jumps off this boat, and it's like, you know, everyone's cheering, yeah, Simon, Simon. And sort of 10 minutes later, he's only 10 foot away from the boat, and you're like, oh my God, he's actually going to drown. It was like that. I was down below. Manu, I saw the shadow fly past. I was like, what's that?
No.
And I just heard a, you know, everyone needs to get out the water. There's a man in the water. There's a man in the water, please. And it was like, it's going off. And I went up, who the hell's jumped off the ferry?
Yeah.
Manu in his pants. And I was like, lads, why? Why has he done that? And they're like, oh,
is this in the middle of the World Cup?
No, this was at the end. This is after we'd lost.
Oh, that's okay.
And someone had said to him, I bet you won't do it. And he was like, I will. And you're like, and he jumped in, and then he then got arrested by the police. And that just finally ended it. And to the point where, and then the worst part of it was there was a lot of infighting at the RFU, and they asked all the players to review the World Cup. And I said, listen, I've got my own drama. I'm not reviewing anything. Yeah. I'm not. But loads of lads reviewed it, and they slated everyone. And then the RFU got it leaked, and the whole thing fell apart. And Martin Johnson, who actually, I think if he'd been allowed to choose his own, or had started from a blank canvas, done what he was supposed to do, and just be a director of rugby and manage everything, he would have been brilliant, because he's a fantastic man, an incredible leader, an inspirational guy. But basically, for a number of reasons, it didn't work out. And he got thrown under the bus with his coaching staff, and it's really unfortunate because rugby lost an incredible mind.
Sure.
But it was the worst thing. And then obviously Stuart Lancaster came in and had to re-educate the British public and the players on the values of playing for England. We had to be seen to be whiter than white.
So Martin Johnson goes, Stuart Lancaster comes in, and 2015, the World Cup is in England. Now, obviously, huge expectation. England pulled with Fiji, Wales and Australia. You managed to beat Fiji, but lose to Australia in the final pool game, which knocks you out. But it's the loss in the middle against Wales, 26th of September at Twickenham, that was the turning point. Now, could it have been different? 28-25 down, 3 minutes left on the clock, and England get a penalty to tie up, but the decision is made to go for the line out and try and win the game, which proves to be a mistake.
And they go for the corner. England go for the corner. They go for the win. A draw still leaves both of these teams in a precarious position.
Can you talk me through what happened and whether it should have been different?
So, look, I've got a lot of friends who are still playing in that situation. I will say, and I said this at the time, and I can tell you it's not Chris Robshaw's fault one bit. He took the can for something that was not his fault, you know, and you know, I don't want to go into it more than that.
Well, this is a penalty, isn't it? Do you kick to go for the draw or maybe go
Let's put it this way.
Roll the dice.
This is going to get me in trouble. I'd say this. There weren't a lot of people putting their hands up to kick.
Right.
So, if you're not going to look to kick, and no tea came on from the sidelines, no one recommended anything, and Robbo looked at his options and just went, I'm going to go for the corner and score a try. That's what I'm going to do, because nobody else wants anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And because of that, he made a decision. And, you know, in any other game, the tee would have come on the field and it would have run it on and made his decision for him. But the kickers, I don't think, felt all of them. Mm. There was a plethora of them on the field, decided they couldn't have a go with it, and they decided to go for touch. And
it
Robbo,
wasn't easy, was it? It wasn't easy.
No, it wasn't. And Robbo went to the corner and got absolutely hammered, so much so that when we played England versus Wales at Twickenham again under Eddie Jones, once that game finished, he sat in the change room in tears. In pieces that we'd won, and he'd buried his demon, and he'd done it, and he'd buried the hatchet, because I think it was an awful time of life, and everybody dug him out, and put him every meme, everything, you know, how'd you not do this? Thank you, Chris Roger. Sure. And he got stitched, and got stitched and carried the can, and he doesn't deserve it. And it was nobody's fault, because we didn't execute what we were supposed to do. But I said, there were not a lot of people putting their hands up. And the coaches, if I was in the coach's box, I'd be mic'd up. I would have got that water boy guy on to run that tee on and just given it to them.
Yeah.
But he didn't do it. Everyone was looking around at everyone else. And it's the same thing in those situations. It's nobody's fault, because there's no guarantee he would have made the kick or anything.
Mm.
But, you know, it was not as bad as everyone says it was. And, you know, he had to bury his demons. And that, I think he still wears that now. And it's, you know, and that's... the beauty and horrific nature of professional sport.
Well, let me ask you this. What happened afterwards, when you went into the dressing room afterwards?
I actually came on for Billy Vannapolo because he got his injured. I mean, everyone, it was like desolation. It was desolation in that change room, but we knew if we could beat Australia. And then I wasn't involved in Australia, and we went and had that week, and I was in the stand. And when we got absolutely humped, and I can't remember what the name of the Foley for Australia was on fire, and they absolutely destroyed us, beat us. I remember sitting in that change room, and I ran out of that stadium, got into the car, got driven back to the stadium. I remember being in the shower, and my wife was in my room, and I just walked in, and I was like singing a song, going like, I won't say what we're saying, but I was essentially, we've messed this up really badly. And I was like, wow, this is going to get bad. Because having had 2011, home soil, all this pomp, all this ceremony, this was bad. And then we played Uruguay. I played, didn't play great, dropped a ball to score a try. We won. And I was like, do you know what? That's me done. Never going to play for England again, never seen again. But luckily, when I was playing for us, I got a phone call from a number I didn't know. And it was like, Hess, mate, Sidney Jones, how are you? And I was like, lads, come on. He's like, nah, mate, it's Sidney Jones. I'm going to pick the Six Nations squad, need you in the team. I'm going to pick starting seven, need a big game for you. Speak to you later, mate. And I was like, oh, my God. First of all, I can't believe he's got my number. Secondly, he wants me to start seven. And thirdly, he's told me I'm starting in the first game. No one's ever done that to me. No one's ever told me I'm in. No one's ever called me up. And that was the start of one of the best journeys I've ever had in England.
Well, he was the guy, wasn't he, for you?
Yeah.
And do you regret that it came late?
Yes. I would. So I remember one of our first meetings after a week with Eddie Jones, myself, Joe Marler, Ben Youngs, Owen Farrell, Dylan Hartley, Danny Kerr, sitting in a room in Penny Hill, looking around at each other with coffee and went, wow. And then Youngs went, would you swap the rest of your caps you had? And I had 50-something. 55, would you swap the rest of them to have more time like this? I went, yeah, in a heartbeat. Every single one of us agreed. And every single one of us went, whatever we do, do not mess this up. And because the environment was so good, we were treated like adults. We were having fun. It was aspirational. We were given everything to help us get better. Every single one of them started self-policing. Other young players not doing what they need to do, sort it out. Players not picking up rubbish, sort it out. People not doing their homework, sort it out. People not playing with attention, sort it out. For once, that's what it was created. And that's why it was so good. And everybody loves to slate Eddie. But I say this, everybody slates Eddie is always on the outside. And it's a bit like walking past some frosted glass and working out what's going on the other side of it. You can guess, tattletale, but no one in that squad wants to get rid of Eddie Jones. All the media outside who know nothing about anything because they'd never go in and see it and don't know what they're talking about, want to get rid of him. I've asked the lads, I've gone in there when there's been a bit of media hype and I've looked them in the face and said, listen, lads, no, I know I've got my podcast, Good Bad Rugby, and you know people think I'm easily swayed with a bit of cash. But I said to listen, what's the story? Has he still got it? Every single man said, absolutely. Yeah. Best there, best has been, the best. And it was out of five coaches, and I know everybody has their one person, but out of five coaches, by far and away the best, by far and away the most professional environment of anything I've ever worked with. One of the best coaches, best men, like, boom. Does he always get it right? No. You know, are we all fallible? Yeah. But does he ultimately have the right course of action in his mind? Is he the best person to do it? Yeah. And for me, that's all you can ask for.
And it came to a crescendo, I guess, at the end. You were playing fantastic rugby and then the injury. At what point, because this is always the most difficult thing for any elite sports person to actually face, I guess, is, you know, the career is coming to an end. So finally then, James, what happened with the injury then?
Yeah, so I mean, I had my toe reconstructed after that second test in 2017 on my left foot. I mean, David Hayes made toe injuries not cool, but they're awful. If you actually get them done, yeah, they are unbearable.
It sounds like it's a toe.
It is, that's what I mean. Yeah. But they are unbearable, especially your big toe because you do it for everything, balance, propulsion, everything. And then I basically stopped halfway through the season to have ankle surgery on my other ankle. By the time I came back, my toe had flared up and I was unable to play. And do you know what the hardest thing was? Almost mentally, when I got injured, it was like, oh, this is the end. This is the end. And I was like, oh my God, I spent my whole career trying to fight these demons away. Because when you get done early, you think you can recover. Mm. But I suddenly became acutely aware of my age, what I was doing, the chance of making the World Cup. Could I do it? And I was so sad and in almost like a bit of a vortex of doom around that. And I remember just one day I was like, I just can't do this anymore. And, you know, part of me thinks as if I'd taken some time away. Could I have recovered? Could I have done something, tried different? Because even though I shopped around different medical opinions. When I was doing I was able to do the MMA stuff and that, you know, that's in some respects is more extreme, but I tried some different physio at that point in time. The honest answer is I just had to call it, and I wasn't where I wanted to be, and I wasn't enjoying it, and I was sad, and I was you know, despondent.
What's the moment like? Do you, is it like typing an email and going, right, this is now ready to go?
I mean, my wife says I'm emotionally dead, but I didn't even cry on a wedding day, which she's never forgiven me for, but I went in to speak to the team and I burst into tears. Yeah. I couldn't speak. Yeah. You know, that one is, I said, lads, I can't do this anymore. I'm sorry, I'm going to retire and that's me done. And I was in like proper bawling. Couldn't speak. And because for all the bravado and all the stuff and all the opinions, you know, the one thing that I've always taken credit in and always enjoyed is always been a good team man. And so because of that, the team stuff was the most important thing in my career. Being around those lads, dying, sort of not dying with them, but training with them, working hard with them, suffering hardship through them, the highs, the lows, the emotions, the laughter, laughing every day for 19 seasons. Some people at work don't laugh at all. I was laughing like 99 times a day. To have all of that and then to have to call it and not know what, you know, the unknown was, and be sad for yourself, sad that you couldn't go and do what you wanted to do, because from my knees upwards, I'm fine. Mm. My head, fine. I'm 30, you know, I was 35. To retire, to go, that's it, and to find something else to do, and your whole life had been defined by that. It's not James Haskell, the DJ at the time, or James Haskell, the coffee maker, or the digger driver. James Haskell, the rugby player. That's what it was. And so that whole emotional thing, and luckily, because I'd put so much time into my mental health and my psychology, meant that I was prepared, but still, it doesn't prepare you for everything.
Well, it's some story, and it's been a great career. James Haskell, confidence man, thank you for joining me on My Sporting Life.
Thanks, mate.
My Sporting Life on Talk Sports.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.